At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There isn't much that's clever to say today, so we're just going to get going. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 14th of December. Good to have you with us. It is a day I think we're all going to remember for a good long time. The president spoke about the shootings in Newtown, Connecticut earlier today.
We've endured too many of these tragedies in the past few years. And each time I learn the news, I react not as a president, but as anybody else would, as a parent. And that was especially true today. I know there's not a parent in America who doesn't feel the same overwhelming grief that I do.
There is no way to make sense of what happened, so we're not going to try. We're going to do the other things that we do. Here for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond, we've got Catherine Rampell. She's at the New York Times today. Felix Salmon from Reuters. He is in our tiny little studio in New York City. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Okay.
So I'll tell you what, let's go blessedly back in time. The chairman of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, gave a press conference on, Wednesday and said some interesting things. One of which, Felix, was that there is now a number he's looking for on unemployment before he raises rates, 6.5%.
6.5%, which is quite a ways from where we are right now. If everything goes according to plan, we might get there in 2014, fingers crossed.
No.
But this makes sense. This is what's known as the Evans rule to policy wonks. We're going to give up just sort of saying we're going to keep rates low for the time being or for a year or something. And they say, listen, so long as there's high unemployment, we're going to have very low interest rates, which is common sense, really.
Catherine, you agree with that, common sense?
I think it makes a lot of sense. And actually, the Fed did not really change its projection on when it would be lowering rates in terms of year terms. I mean, when we get down to 6.5% is about where we would be when the Fed said that they would be lowering rates, you know, back under the old regime. And one advantage of using this system where they peg it to a number as opposed to a year is that they don't have to keep on pushing out their estimate for how long it's going to be when they tighten monetary policy, which could be bad for confidence. You know, if they're vocally saying, oh, we think it's actually going to take a little bit longer than we had previously expected, that means that they have less faith in the economy.
You know what I should have done, Felix, was figure out how long it will take at current rates of job growth in this country to get to 6.5%. Did you actually run the numbers and it's 2014 sometime?
One of the problems is that we really have no idea. And the headline unemployment rate is a very fuzzy number. And Ben Bernanke, when he gave his press conference, was a bit more grown up about it. And he said, we're going to look at all of the unemployment figures, the underemployment figures, the number of people who are looking for – who are part-time and looking for full-time work and all of those kind of things. And we're not having a hard 6.5% in the U1 target. They're just saying we want unemployment to come down to something vaguely tolerable. And that's what 6.5% is.
Catherine,
there are bad ways to get to 6.5% too, like lots of people dropping out of the labor force.
Right, right. It's that labor force participation rate, which economists love to point at. The other thing the Fed chairman did, Catherine, was say, you know what? We're going to keep on buying bonds. In fact, we're going to buy more bonds. We're going to buy treasuries and keep interest rates low. How much more can the Fed do? Every time people say the Fed can't do anymore, he comes out and he says, oh, yeah, we're going to buy some more stuff.
I think at this point, you know, the The amount that that will actually benefit the economy is probably pretty marginal, and that's been the case for a while. Mm-hmm. You know, that the first time they pump a lot of money into the economy, it does a lot of good. The second time they do it, maybe a little bit less good, and then you get diminishing returns from there on out. That said, you know, there's very little risk at this point to the Fed trying to do more. Mm-hmm. So maybe the upside is small, but the downside is pretty much negligible at this point. So the Fed can keep on doing what it's doing, even if it doesn't actually have a huge material impact on the economy. At least it's good for confidence. At least people say, oh, look, the Fed is doing what it can, even if Congress is not.
So, yeah, well, speaking of which, Felix, Mr. Bernanke did his ritual washing of hands and basically said, you know what, fiscal policymakers, by which he means the president and Congress, you guys need to step up because this cliff thing is real and it's going to do bad things. So, which gets me to two questions. One, do you believe we're going to go off that cliff? And two, is it going to be bad?
Yes, and sort of. I'm beginning to think right now as we rapidly approach Christmas that we're not going to have a signed deal and everything sealed before January the 1st. So technically, come January 1, we've gone off the cliff. But it's not really – it's one of those tiny little baby cliffs. It's only just like a step really rather than a cliff.
Yeah, it's like a
step. And you know, if we stay off – you know, if we don't come to a deal for months after that, then we have real problems. But we can definitely cope with a few weeks without coming to a deal. That wouldn't be the end of the world.
Catherine Rampell, last word to you today. What is the first thing that's going to happen when the deal doesn't happen, right, when we go off that slope?
The first thing that's going to
happen.
How are
we going to know that it's, you know, actually happening?
Because we're waking up with a hangover on the first
thing. That's right. New day.
I mean, I don't think you're going to see that suddenly people find that there's a lot less money in their bank accounts than there was the day before or anything like that. But you could see some real panic in the financial markets. You know, if investors and businesses think that Congress is so dysfunctional that they can't get their act together, that maybe their taxes are all going to go up and that spending cuts are going to come in, you know.
It's that confidence thing again, right? I mean, that's what it is.
Yeah, it's that confidence thing. I mean, there is a real impact of Congress actually letting the United States go over the fiscal cliff, which is that it would shave probably around 3 percentage points off of GDP growth next year, which we absolutely cannot afford.
If you work for or near a lot of defense contractors, then that would have a massive impact.
All right, we got to go. Felix Salmon and Catherine Rampell, see you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Guy.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. On Wall Street today, a fittingly downbeat session. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This has been a turnaround year at Yahoo, or maybe I should say this has been another turnaround year at Yahoo. The new CEO, Marissa Mayer, has promised to change that company's culture. She's giving out more free lunches. Everybody gets a smartphone, anything they wanted, just not a BlackBerry, that kind of thing. And more substantive stuff, too. Today, Mayer announced another new member of Yahoo's board of directors, one of the founders of PayPal, as it happens, which just about turns over that entire board in just 1 year. Marketplace's Eve Tro explains what difference that might make.
Corporations have branches, kind of like the federal government. So you can think of the board of directors and the management as two branches that keep each other in check.
The board is there to monitor the management for the benefit of the investors, to ensure that management is running the company effectively.
That's Charles Elson. He studies corporate governance at the University of Delaware. He says board members clock about 6 weeks' worth of hours per year, so a serious candidate shouldn't already sit on lots of other boards. Investors also shouldn't be wowed by celebrity board members, as they have in the past.
The old idea was that you fill a board with as many ex-politicians as you can because people know their names.
Might a jeans and t-shirt startup superstar be today's equivalent? Well, Max Levchin, a founder of PayPal, can lay claim to internet expertise. And in a blog post, he laid out personal reasons for taking the board position, including a sentimental feeling toward Yahoo, which showed him, quote, computer geeks can start companies that create the future. But Levchin also cited admiration for Yahoo's CEO. That can be a red flag, says Jeffrey McFadden at law firm Steptoe & Johnson.
You have powerful chief executive officers who want people on the board that are going to go along with what the CEO wants to do.
He says federal watchdogs and major investors are scrutinizing the true independence of corporate boards more than ever. They want board members to focus on the long-term health of companies, not quick profits. I'm Eve Troeh for Marketplace.
There's word today another very expensive shoe is about to drop over the rigging of a key interest rate, the London Interbank Offered Rate, LIBOR in the vernacular. According to several reports, the Swiss bank UBS is likely to be fined somewhere near $1 billion for its role in the scandal. It would be the biggest civil settlement in that case yet. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports the banks may be too big to criminally prosecute, but employees could still be in the crosshairs.
There's a reason that banks and international regulators have been negotiating these settlement deals. Taking a bank to court could bring what amounts to a death penalty.
By criminally prosecuting a bank, it can be prevented from participating in the financial system, which would, in essence, destroy the bank.
Former federal prosecutor Jacob Frankel is a securities law attorney outside Washington, D.C. He says these civil penalties avoid that. This week, British authorities made their first arrest in the interest rate rigging probe, and Frankel says that opens a path to prosecution that's less destabilizing for the banks.
Now the authorities are focused on the responsible individuals.
At the University of Delaware, Professor Charles Elson says prosecuting people makes more sense than going after the institution. When a bank faces charges, it's the shareholders who will pay, and they didn't do anything wrong.
It's kind of like saying we're going to go after the getaway car as opposed to the person robbing the bank and driving the car.
Maybe. Northwestern University accounting professor Thomas Lease suggests the bank bears some liability if it encouraged the wrong corporate culture.
The question to the institution is, was there sufficient supervision, and or maybe there was even inducement to kind of push the limits of what's acceptable.
If that's the case, Lease points out the banks involved might not be home free just yet. Lease expects a flood of civil lawsuits over potentially many billions of dollars in damages from people harmed by the rate rigging. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Workplace wellness is one of those phrases that really doesn't mean so much. A guy from Google doing yoga, maybe, or a fancy fitness center in the basement of company headquarters where management goes to sweat things out. But as corporate insurance premiums keep going up, workplace wellness is becoming everybody's business. Kelly Weiss has that story.
At the Mariani Nut Company outside of Sacramento, workers wearing hairnets sort a steady stream of almonds and walnuts as they pour onto conveyor belts. Business as usual. But middle-aged factory workers dripping sweat and pumping iron at the plant's on-site gym, not so usual. A group of Latino workers show up regularly to CrossFit classes to lift weights, run, and jump rope in this converted conference center. Amelia Dame came over to class after her shift of
cleaning, mopping, sweeping, all this.
Deme is 58 and says she'd never been to a gym before. But with this gym on site and free classes, she decided to try it out.
I was not even able to do the jump rope one or two, twice. I just tried to keep jumping, but I couldn't.
She kept trying, and now she's 10 pounds lighter. She also has more money in her pocket. As a reward for her efforts, Mariani now picks up Deme's share of her health insurance premium, about $1,100 a year. Robin Stenson is the HR manager for the Nut Company. She says the incentive program came about after employees took a health screening test 3 years ago.
Well, we found that the rate of diabetes, obesity, and high blood pressure was very alarming.
Alarming because almost every worker had one of these conditions. So the company put up a couple $1,000s for gym equipment. And now Stinson says it spends about $25,000 a year on its wellness program. She says that may sound like a lot, but
considering, you know, you're paying over $1 million in premiums as far as insurance goes, so that's just kind of a drop in the bucket.
And it's a drop in the bucket more companies are willing to make, according to Don Powell. He's the head of the American Institute for Preventive Medicine and advises businesses on wellness programs.
Approximately 78% of companies offer a worksite wellness program.
Powell says for these businesses, it's about saving money. He says they're finally grasping that the vast majority of healthcare spending is on preventable diseases, many of them linked to obesity. But there's a snag when it comes to lower wage workers.
It is more difficult to motivate blue-collar workers to participate in wellness programs because they don't have the same degree of interest of people of higher socioeconomic backgrounds.
But at the same time, blue-collar workers are more likely to be overweight, diabetic, and use tobacco. What's a business to do?
To do nothing costs them money. The average employer is spending around $10,000 per employee per year for health care, and that's just not sustainable.
So more companies are balancing incentives for better health with penalties for those who don't want to make changes. And under the new health law, employers have more flexibility to raise the stakes on each side. Overweight workers who won't diet or get on an exercise program, for instance, could see their premiums jump by as much as 30%. Powell says he's not convinced these types of carrots and sticks make a lasting, real difference. He says to get the best results, the workplace culture has to change.
That consists of CEOs and management people being involved in the challenges and losing weight alongside the people that work in the processing plant.
Back at the Mariani Nut Company, this is happening. Robin Stenson, the HR manager, is wearing her CrossFit shirt and spotting an employee lifting weights.
She's push-pressing 50 pounds. They get to a certain point and you can actually push them up a little bit further. A little bit of assistance, not much. They do it all themselves.
With a little bit of help from the boss, I'm Kelly Weiss for Marketplace.
Kelly's story was produced for us with the California Healthcare Foundation Center for Health Reporting. Coming up, the catfish economy.
A lot of our area is driven by the catfish industry. It is the economic engine that drives West Alabama.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street turned down today after more than a week of gains. The Dow Industrials dropped 35 points, about 0.25%, closed at 13,135. The NASDAQ gave away 20 points, about 0.7%, 29.71 at the bell. The S&P 500, white lost 5 points, 0.4%, finished at 14.13. The major markets were down for the week. The Dow and the NASDAQ by 0.2%, the S&P by 0.3%. Financials hung in there. Morgan Stanley climbed almost 1.5%. Citigroup up about 0.8% today. Apple lost an almost 4% chunk on concerns about continued growth and a ruling that it infringed on patents connected to Sony and Nokia. Nokia bumped up 1.5%. Adobe built nearly 6% by beating expectations today. Yahoo added 1.5%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell 1.7%, the number there. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at some reports coming out next week. Each of these looks back at November. The Commerce Department releases new residential construction figures. A little more info on the health of the housing market. The National Association of Realtors provides existing home sales numbers. And late in the week, the Labor Department reports on personal income and spending. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The housing collapse that we are just now getting out from under in this country wasn't just ours. You know, Europe had one of its own that they are still dealing with. There's a lot of empty property over there. Cheap property, too. But Spaniards in particular, wrapped up in their own financial crisis, aren't buying. So the government is planning to offer foreigners a sweet deal. You buy a house, you get a green card. From Barcelona, Robert Downs reports.
Surrounded by the Mediterranean, the Spanish island of Mallorca has a lot going for it. Constant sunshine, white sand beaches, and the food's not bad either. A studio apartment here will set you back $24,000. Other parts of Spain can be just as cheap. A four-bedroom house in northern Spain's wine country cost just $33,000. Foreigners were scouring the country for vacation homes even before the European economic crisis hit.
And now they have the same opportunities, the same properties, but up to 80% of discount.
Alfredo Milla works for the real estate arm of the Spanish bank Sabadell. He shows me some of the hundreds of discounted properties on his books, including one very nice place, down from $230,000 to $71,000.
This property is in a golf court with all the conditions to be a very good experience for the client. And in addition to this, it's a 15 minutes for the beach.
Spain's housing bubble popped in 2007, but prices have taken a while to fall. Banks own most of the property in Spain, and they resisted dropping prices as long as they could. José García Montalvo is an economics professor at Barcelona's Pompeu Fabra University.
They were trying to, you know, extend and pretend that nothing happened and keeping those prices very high.
That was then. Now, banks are trying to sell off their assets, and prices are falling fast. The first 8 months of this year saw the biggest year-on-year drop in real estate prices in Spain's history. So, the government and the banks are eager for foreigners to buy up empty property. A few years ago, foreigners trying to buy here faced a sea of red tape. No more, says Carlos Bode.
There's not a problem today to close a real estate transaction in Spain with total safety and security.
The plan to give residency to buyers of pricey homes is attractive to visitors like Americans, who, without a visa, can only normally stay here for 90 days. But foreigners from China, Russia, and North Africa can't even come in without a lengthy application process. So for them, the prospect of residency and free movement within Europe seems like a great deal. That's true for real estate companies, too. They stand to make big profits in sales. But some Spaniards fear it could draw shady foreigners, people using black market funds or money launderers. Professor José García Montalvo has personal experience with this.
My uncle sold a house 10 years ago to a Russian person that came with a bag. With $500,000 in a bag. So, I mean, that's not the kind of investment that you want to promote.
It's not yet certain that lawmakers will pass the new residency law. But admirers of Spain say that even if they don't, knock down prices and the chance to spend the winter in sunshine make this a great place to call home. In Barcelona, I'm Robert Downs for Marketplace.
Not often you get to talk about catfish noodling on a business program, sticking your hand down in those holes those guys swim in and hoping they bite you. But talk about it, we did last time we had Townsend Kaiser on the program. He's a catfish farmer in Greensboro, Alabama, who was suffering in the Midwest drought and getting some help from the government last time we talked this past summer. Mr. Kaiser, it is good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, Kai. How are you today?
I'm all right, thanks. So listen, last time we talked, back in August, we were asking about that $10 million from the Department of Agriculture to help out with the catfish industry.
Yes, sir.
How was your late summer and early fall? How'd it go for you?
It went a lot better.
Good.
In West Alabama, we got a little bit more rain, which helped us a good bit. Some of the other areas in our state didn't fare as well. But we've gotten a lot more rain, and our area is doing a lot better. A lot of agriculture in our area is doing a lot better.
So that $10 million from the Department of Agriculture helped you out a little bit?
It helped a whole lot move some of our product out and helped us a considerable bit. Yes, sir.
You know, last time we talked, you were worried about grain. And first of all, I was surprised that catfish eat grain. But you were talking about how expensive it is. Has it gotten more expensive since the drought?
Yes, sir, it has. The prices have somewhat stabled, but we hope that they will fall a little bit in the U.S. market to help lower our cost of production. Agriculture is a very tightly knit group across this country, and when things happen in certain areas, they affect the whole nation as far as in our world of agriculture.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's been very crucial to to have good crops in the Midwest, good grain crops in the Midwest.
How much grain do you go through in, say, I don't know, a month to feed your catfish crop?
Well, it'd be easier to break it down in a year because some months we feed more than others. And in the summer, we feed more than others. But we feed approximately 5,000 tons of feed every summer, every year.
Wow. This one's going to sound like it's completely out of left field, but do you guys give a rat's patootie about the fiscal cliff and that whole thing that Washington's talking about?
Very, very much so.
Hmm.
For several reasons. A lot of it has to do with the taxes, as you can imagine, and a lot of middle class working people in this area can't afford to pay any more taxes. It takes a lot of capital and a lot of things to have an operation of any size. And when you start playing with those numbers, it really starts to affect what farmers and their children can be able to do in the future.
Last time we talked, you mentioned you had 18 people. I think that's the number, 18 people working for you. Have you been able to keep them employed even as business has slowed?
Yes, sir, we have. We're doing the best we can. We have continued to keep them employed. We're finding good things for everybody to do, and it's picking up a little bit. We hope that we can continue to and hope to hire a few more folks beginning of next year, maybe.
Townsend Kaiser, he does catfish in Greensboro, Alabama. Mr. Kaiser, thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you, too, Kyle. You have a nice day.
All right, I will.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today about what happened in Newtown, Connecticut this morning. And I should tell you right at the beginning, this isn't going to be something you usually hear on this broadcast. But as I think I've said, I don't know, a couple of times, maybe, I've got four little kids at home. Anyway, my first reaction was that there wasn't really an angle for us in this, that we'd leave it to others. But then we thought about it, and we did some digging around. And we found lobbying numbers and gun sales numbers and firearms permit numbers. And then we found this. There are, according to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, more than 58,000 places you can buy a gun in this country. That's more gun shops than there are Starbucks in the whole world. Jay Carney, the press secretary for the President of the United States, said this morning, before the president spoke, he said that this isn't the time to talk about gun control. But if now's not the time, then when is? Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.